Hi, I'm JT White, author, digital native, and product person, obsessed with trying to find out how to make digital products and the people that make them the best we possibly can. This is Build for Better. My guest today is Danny Nathan. After 20 years of product and technology experience, Danny has developed a habit of helping companies create new products and services and launch new ventures. In the past, he's been called a product person, a UX guy, a designer, a strategist, a marketer, a creative, and a few other choice names like the cleaner. Today, Danny is the founder of Apollo 21, a company which sits at the intersection of a business consultancy, a product design studio, and a venture studio. Apollo 21 helps companies foster innovation, leverage venture-driven growth, and remove barriers to scale by building technology that solves complex business and operational challenges. Throughout his career, Danny has led product build and launch efforts at an international scale, run countless design sprints, and founded multiple companies. He's applied his expertise to a variety of companies ranging from pre-seed startups to Fortune 100 corporations, including Amex, Dyson, General Mills, MoMA, Getty Images, Legendary Pictures, and many more. I am lucky to call Danny a friend and someone that I turn to for advice often, and just somebody I love to talk to. This is Danny.
All right, Daniel, this has been a long time coming.
It has. How long have we been teasing this? A good 3 months or something?
I don't know. I think longer, actually. Yeah. I think it's been even
probably longer. Has been longer at this point.
I'm very excited to have you on for a lot of reasons. The main reason is because I just adore the way that you think, and you picked like one of my favorite and least favorite topics of all time. Cause I talked to you about this very early on, cause you were one of the first people that I thought, man, I feel like just like digging into Danny's brain would be a lot of fun and potentially good fodder. And then you said, I think I want to talk about failure. And I was like, oh my God.
Yes. Yeah. It has become a topic over the last, I don't know, my entire career slash the last few years that is just constantly top of mind. And I've been thinking a lot about just our, like, people's relationships to failure in general. And, like, you know, when you talk startups and entrepreneurship and all of that stuff, failure inevitably comes up. And it's such a unique space to play with the idea of failure because you're going to fail, full stop. And yeah, it's one that I think about a lot. I have sort of this like vaguely personal mantra that is fail beautifully. And it's one of those like constant reminders of anything worth doing is worth doing well and kind of giving your all. And if you're going to fail at it, you might as well fail doing it as well as you can and fail in the most, you know, beautiful, epic, disastrous way possible.
Yeah. So I want to start with the why, not to be all Simon Sinek-y, but like, why do you think about failure so much? Like, what was the, cause like when I asked you about doing this, it came like you said it immediately. And I don't know that I had even fully pitched you on what the podcast was going to be yet. And you were like, I want to talk about failure. And I was like, okay. Like, why did it jump like that? Like, why is it at the forefront of your mind so much?
It really, I mean, fail beautifully really is kind of a personal mantra, and it goes through my head multiple times a day. And I've been digging into it a lot more of late, in part because things have been a little difficult lately. And so I think about what failure means and am I setting myself up for failure and, you know, what does it mean to fail, basically? And one of the things that really kind of got me started thinking about it was just the notion of what failure means and why failure, the idea of failure, why failing has such kind of a personal meaning to us as people. And one of the thoughts that kind of came to mind is that we're taught from a very young age that failure is bad. Failure is the opposite of success. If you have failed, then you've done something wrong, or you are less than or not as good as, or whatever, you know, whatever euphemism you want to throw at it. And the deeper into my career I get, and the more time that I spend thinking about building products, building companies, and what it takes to create success out of that, the more I realize that failure is both completely inevitable and, instead of being a bad thing, is really the essence of learning. You know, we talk about, at least in, you know, in startup land, we talk all the time about, you know, what is the hypothesis behind whatever we're doing now? What is driving this experiment? And experiments fail, and that's fine. Nobody, you know, nobody says, oh, my experiment failed and I didn't learn anything from it. It was a waste of time. It's my experiment failed and I learned why. And now I know something that I shouldn't do. And ideally, I have an idea of what I can do to make it better next time. So failure to me represents kind of a contrarian way of looking at the world through the lens of learning and growing.
I mean, so many things from that description. So let's start with why, like, what failure meant to you and when this mind shift happened. Because I'm going to go out on a, like, I, first of all, it's important for people to know, I do know you personally. We're friends. Like, we know each other. So I'm going to assume that there was, this has not always been your ethos. I'm going to assume that you had to grow into comfortable with failure or appreciative even of failure. So, like, where is there a moment in time or an event or something that you can, like, sort of pinpoint when the shift in your brain started to happen?
If I look back on it, it has been instilled for years, but the kind of pivot point, I think, has happened over, call it the last, like, 9 to 12 years. And so let me back up for a second and kind of explain why it's been inherent in my life, and then I'll come back around to the pivot point. But a lot of people don't know this about me, but I grew up spending a ton of time in theater. I was an acting major in college, and I, you know, a lot of, when you study acting at a college level, you know, at a highly academic level, you get into the whys behind the thinking, and you know, you start talking about what are the choices that you're making to bring a character to life, and oftentimes those choices fail. And it was one of the, you know, being in the theater and kind of exploring the development of a character and how you bring something to life on stage, in this case, to demonstrate to people and tell a story, really was sort of the earliest onus for the idea of failure and the idea that failing isn't necessarily bad. It's just trying and trying and trying again to construct a thing that will tell a story. And so after acting, I went into advertising, and I had a professor who always talked about growing thick skin, about getting feedback on your work and stuff. And I sort of realized during grad school then that, frankly, I sort of came in with pretty thick skin after years of having, you know, acting professors and directors and stuff yell at you, no, that's not what I want, do this. And so I started thinking about it more there. And then to bring it back to that kind of pivot point that I was talking about, I've had a really weird and kind of roller coaster career path, which, you know the story of pretty well. And I think about failure a lot because I don't have the inherent feeling that I have succeeded in the manner that I want to in my career. And so then you start kind of creeping into the territory of failure versus imposter syndrome and thinking about, am I as good as I want to be, or as I think I could be, or as, you know, if you're lucky and you're talking to the right people, as people tell you you are, things like that. And so especially over the last few years, and as I've started dedicating more and more of my career path towards, you know, building ventures, building products, building companies where failure is just utterly inherent in the process, it's that kind of trajectory of my career that has really gotten me thinking a lot about failure. And, you know, the last few years in building Apollo 21 have been really tough. And so I think about failure and whether I deserve to be or should be sitting in the seat that I'm sitting in rather often these days.
So, okay. So I have a question now. How do you define success?
That's a really good question.
Gotcha.
Yeah. I mean, there's obvious measures for success that are, you know, largely kind of financially driven and things like that. And I'm, you know, without digging too deeply, I'm still working towards that. But at the same time, for me, success, I think, is feeling like something that I have created has been seen through to fruition in a manner that, even if it doesn't result in a huge financial exit or something like that, at least has kept me going and has made me feel like if I'm going to stop doing it, I'm going to make that choice of my own accord and not because I couldn't keep doing it for whatever reason, be it financial or otherwise. But, you know, to me, the idea of, you know, failing a startup or failing a company is, oh, we had to shut it down. You know, we couldn't afford to keep going, couldn't make any money on it, whatever. And so I guess for me right now, success is I can reasonably support myself and my team doing what we enjoyed doing through Apollo 21 or whatever the venture is, and feeling like if we have to stop, it's because we want to and not because we're forced to.
I love that. I think one of the things that's interesting that I heard, right? So you talked about being in theater, which is whatever, right? Like, very interesting.
Yes, it's very whatever.
It is. I mean, I went to school for psychology. I could barely throw any sticks here. But then you also talked about advertising. And I think what's interesting about those things, it's very different from the space that you occupy now and that we occupy, because I live in the same world, is that my previous life, and it sounds like your previous life, your success was actually measured by other people. So when you're on stage, your success is measured by somebody who's telling you you did a good job. In advertising, the client says you did a good thing. Now that you're building the thing, you have to define what makes it good or not good, which is a very different problem set to solve.
That's a really interesting perspective, JT. I had never thought about it in those terms, I'll be honest. And I love that you were forcing me to think about it in new terms. I don't know that I have a great response for that other than like facepalm. Oh my God. Holy shit. Like, I don't know. Can we have a therapy session next?
Well, there's no response, but it's just, it dawns on me. Cause like one of the things that I know I've really struggled with, right, is like, I don't know what success looks like, but boy, can I define failure for you. Yeah. And it's one of those things where, you know, I can, if somebody asks me to name like the top five failures in my career, oh boy, they're right there. I mean, I have
you got about 15 that fit in that.
First of all, how much time do you have? And second of all, what level of detail would you like me to get into? Because I can give you dates. Like, I've got receipts. But then when people say, like, what are the things that you built that you're most proud of? Like, you know, I have kind of like some vapid answers. But then, like, if I really, really think about it, it's almost never the actual thing. It's the thing that built the thing, or the way we built the thing, or
it was the experience of having created it, and the experience of building the team around it, and the experiences that you go through together that give that thing the meaning in your life that it has, if I can cram a bunch of words into your mouth.
No, but I think that's right. And then that, but then that also goes back to defining like it changes the lens entirely of what it is that I look at when I go, well, what's good?
Yeah.
Right. Because like, listen, I know what I want, but what I want is not always perfectly aligned with success for me. And I struggle with it because to me, for a long time, especially like living in Manhattan and following all these people around and doing all this stuff and going to people's second homes and being like, this is the height of luxury. I'm like, clearly, this is what you're supposed to be doing. And the truth is like now as I've gotten older, and I've been able to ask smarter questions because I'm broken and figured that out finally, to be able to ask some of those people, like, I don't actually think that they're successful. They're rich. But like, I don't know that they're like building things or doing things that they feel particularly successful in doing. Their output has given them a successful life. But like the crazy part about entrepreneurship and venture studio stuff is that like, it's really greedy. Like, we're really greedy people. I want both. I want to build the thing that I want to build and have it be meaningful in the world. And I want to do it on my terms with my friends.
You know, it's interesting though, that you bring up kind of meaningful in the world. I ended up on a call recently with a young lady who is an undergrad at my alma mater. I guess that's right. At WashU. And she had just graduated with a degree in UX and was asking about, you know, my perspective on, quote unquote, building things that matter. And what I realized was that building things that matter doesn't necessarily have to be a lofty world-changing goal. You don't have to change millions or, you know, thousands of other people's lives for something to have meaning. You can change three people's lives and derive meaning out of that. And this was a while ago, but if I remember correctly, the example that I gave her, and if I'm wrong, it doesn't matter, it still rings true. You know, I have a couple of guys on my team who I absolutely adore working with that I knew from previous companies. And to me, if we can all have fun working together and create things that we enjoy building that give you the experience that you were just describing. And, you know, if I can put them in a position where their kids can go to college or whatever it is, like, honestly, to me, that is making a difference. And yes, it may not be impacting massive numbers of people, but if I can make 3 people's lives better, I'll take it.
Yeah, that's all about framing, right? Like that's another thing that I think about a lot when it comes to building products, specifically in the digital space, is like we all, I think, have fallen very victim, and I'll speak specifically for myself, but like it's very easy to fall into the unicorn, decacorn, a billion users, blah, blah, blah trap.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, like is dope. Like, don't get me wrong. Like that's what I'm trying to do. Like, it's not what I'm trying to do. But there is a certain amount of me as I've gotten older that is really, really okay and happy with really nailing it for a really small amount of people and making their life wildly better.
Yes. Is
fine for me. I feel very good about that too.
Yeah, full stop. And I mean, when you start talking about unicorns and all of that, and I hate that our conversation here is like consistently kind of revolving back to money, but it is inherently, you know, an assumption around what we do is that the outcome should be financially driven. But I agree, the further I get into my career, the more I realize that I don't think that's a path that I want to run down. You know, the idea of being an entrepreneur in large part to me is attractive because of the personal freedom that it affords and the ability to set your own schedule, manage your own life, work from wherever you want to, you know, take the time to take a walk around the block or, you know, take your wife out to dinner, whatever it is. And the idea then of building a viable, comfortable lifestyle business, for example, suddenly sounds a lot better than the idea of worrying about millions upon millions of dollars of some investor's money because they're breathing down my neck so that they can return that tenfold to some other really rich guy's pocket, you know?
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, so let me ask you a question about that though. So let's go back to failure, right?
Yeah.
So one of the things that is true in the scenario that you just said in a lifestyle business is you get to define failure yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Versus if you are playing with somebody else's capital.
Oh yeah. They'll tell you when you failed.
They define failure for you. Right. And I do think there's meaning in that. Like, I think that, cause you know, my relationship with failure, I think just like yours from what I'm hearing, like has changed dramatically over time. And there was a while in the startup world where I think like every startup office in Manhattan had like the fail forward fast, get shit done.
Yes.
Like there was that world. Which is like, don't get me wrong, like I think the sentiment behind that's beautiful and probably right, but it's also kind of corny if everybody's like, we're going to fail. It's like, no, you shouldn't be trying to fail, but you should be willing to fail is different.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. It's interesting. Along similar lines, I don't remember why I was looking it up, but I was digging into the history of, you know, Zuckerberg's move fast and break things, which I think falls squarely in line with the style of thinking that you're describing here. And I was shocked to find out that move fast and break things hasn't been Facebook's like internal mantra for a full decade.
Yeah.
And in 2014, they moved from move fast and break things to move fast and maintain a stable environment. It's such like a, I don't know. And I, realizing that was in a way like a huge mindfuck because here's, you know, Mark Zuckerberg, who a lot of people put forward as the archetype of, you know, entrepreneurship today. And he's always been known for move fast and break things. And when you stop and realize that for a full 10 years, his mantra has been move fast and maintain a stable environment, like that's just massively impactful. And, you know, all of a sudden, to your point, like the folks roaming the halls, you know, yelling about wanting or trying to fail and moving fast and breaking things just takes on a whole new meaning when you think about the fact that for a full decade now, that has not been like the Silicon Valley mantra, if you will.
Yeah. Well, and it's probably right too, right? And I think that this is like, I think about this, And so, you know, you run a venture studio, and I think venture studios are really interesting for this reason, because, and I think they're important, but in a weird way, I think they're important and deployed in the wrong spaces. Like, I wish bigger companies were working more with venture studios than smaller companies.
Yes. And that is exactly the world that we're going for.
Right. Yeah, I know. And that wasn't like an intentional setup for you. But the reason I really believe that is because I've worked with and on innovation teams at large companies. Yeah. And you can't innovate inside of a big organization, because a big organization, and by the way, they should, has rules and things that they need to make sure doesn't break. And they have to be mindful of stuff like that. But if they just bring somebody in that goes, hey, what if this was different? Like, what would it look like and smell like and feel like? Or what if we wanted to do this but didn't have to think about all these things? How would it work? Because to go back to your conversation about the UX person you just talked to, I actually just had a really cool conversation with a guy on a golf course, believe it or not, and happened to be a UX designer. We knew a bunch of the same people in the world because it's a small industry. And I asked him, I said, hey, so what's your like favorite stuff that you've ever gotten to build? Because it's one of my favorite questions.
Yeah.
And he said, all of the things that I've built that I'm the most proud of have never actually gotten to production.
Yep.
And I was like, if that isn't a thing that every UX designer probably needs to hear in college, I don't know what else is. Because it's true. Because the stuff that you'd be most proud of would be the stuff that would have the biggest impact on the largest user group, potentially. Mm-hmm. And getting your designs all the way through their engineer, like their design team, their product team, their engineering team, their roadmap. It's really hard, man. That's a hard road to hoe, man.
Yeah, it's incredibly difficult. And it's, you know, it's interesting that you say that you feel like in many ways larger companies can't innovate. And well, obviously
internally they can't innovate. Like if they're left to their own devices, I think most of them wind up in the Zuckerberg situation, which is eventually they go, move fast and don't break things.
Yes. Yes. But I think that there's kind of an inherent dichotomy in that, which, you know, you've hinted at, but the companies that I think are doing amazing things and innovative things that are large are the ones that have somebody sitting at the top that have committed to the value of innovation, especially over time. And, you know, innovation is largely culturally driven and, for better or worse, has to be given permission from the top in order to happen. And so,
for sure,
I think a lot of what we're seeing is that, you know, companies are afraid to give that permission, and employees are sure as hell afraid to ask forgiveness.
Well, and I think this all, not to be like the centering topic guy, but this comes back to failure. Like, yes. I think the easiest one for this is consumer devices. I'm not taking digs at Apple or Samsung or anybody, but like realistically, if you look at the innovation, I'm doing air quotes, the innovation that has happened on these phones and on these devices and laptops over the past, like, I don't know, call it 10 plus years. I mean, pretty boring. If we're being really honest with ourselves, it's pretty boring.
Yeah. And I think that's why people have gotten so excited about some of the newer things that are coming out, like the Rabbit and the UX pin and stuff like UX, AI pin. Sorry, I had UX in my head from our conversation there. Arguably, you know, the reviews are starting to come out, and there's a lot of question as to how much value those devices bring. But to your point, the value is that, you know, rightly or wrongly, for better or worse, they're trying. And there is value in that. And, you know, I certainly hope that somebody manages to scare the pants off of Apple enough to, you know, force them to change and to, you know, so that we can get something beyond the next latest and greatest app on our phone. And let's be clear, like, there haven't even been many of those lately. I mean, I can't remember the last app that I downloaded where I kind of said to myself, holy shit, like, how did I live without this? It's all just kind of table stakes at this point.
Yeah, it's all sort of just the deal. Like, it's all the same deal. I mean, I think the thing that I like, what jumps out to me the most right now is that I think there is this inherent, because everything is so shareholder driven, there is this absolute abject, like, just opposition to failure ever.
Yes.
Because nobody wants to go through a poor commercial launch, because they will get lambasted. And let's be clear, they will. Like, 110%, if you do something dumb in public, you're going to get held accountable now, because that's where we live.
Well, we all live in public, and so of course you're going to, but I think you're spot on. And I mean, I think that it's interesting. You asked me about failure and what those kind of pivotal moments were to me earlier. One of the other things that has always echoed in the back of my head throughout my career is I am firmly of the belief that corporate politics is driven by fear, and largely fear of failure or fear of repercussions. And so, you know, we see people who reach a certain point, especially in their corporate career ladder, where they feel like they've made it, or they're kind of, you know, just over the hump of I made VP or whatever that goal is for you personally. And the fear of losing that after working for so long due to a failure, I think is what ultimately drives a lot of the decision making in a corporate setting around, it's a little risky. It makes me scared. Well, I think the unstated part of that is exactly what you just pointed out. It makes me scared to fail, and it makes me scared to fail publicly. And as I said, you know, I consistently come back to fail beautifully. And, you know, I'm firmly of the belief that if people are good at their jobs, they're going to find another one. And so if you're going to go for it and fail beautifully and, you know, deal with the outcome as it comes.
So when you say fail beautifully, like, can you expand on what that means to you? Like, what is it like? I guess to be really succinct about it, what's the difference between failing beautifully and not failing beautifully?
Me not failing beautifully is failing because you didn't try, or because you didn't try hard enough, or failing when there was more that you could have done in order to prove to yourself that you could have been successful. And now I'm throwing air quotes. Thanks for starting that. You know, but I'm success in these terms being more what it means to you personally and less what it means to the outside world. And so for me, the reminder of fail beautifully pops into my head in those moments where, I don't know, I've written an email that, you know, is one of those things that you hesitate to push send on. And yeah. I get to that moment of like, well, fail beautifully, you know. And it's that moment of me kind of throwing my hands in the air and going, I believe that this is correct, so fuck it. I'm going to put it out there and I will deal with the consequences of it, but I'm going to stand by the fact that this is what I believe, or this is what I think is the path forward, or, you know, obviously it's case dependent. But to me, that is, it's in those smallest moments when that big reminder pops back into my head and I go, eh, if you're going to do it, you might as well full send.
Yeah. I think that, like, in products in particular in the digital space, the thing that I'm always fascinated by is how, and like every engineer in the world is going to hit me when they see me in public when I say this, but like, it's really easy to walk stuff back. Mm-hmm. And I get frustrated. Like, the physical world's a little bit different. Like, look, if you spend $1 billion trying to build a new car, and then you release the car and people go, we hate this car, like, you're in trouble. Like, you're in big trouble. But as fast and as far as technology has come in your ability to build software and websites and applications and all this stuff, the idea that people aren't like rapidly producing stuff and then rolling it back when they're wrong and going like, cool, our bad. Like, we thought we had a thing and we
failed.
Wrong. Yeah. Like, we totally messed this one up and we're really glad you guys told us, and we're glad we didn't spend too much time on it. Like,
yeah, absolutely. You know, it's interesting. There's kind of two sides to that coin as well, because you talk about walking something back, but the other side of that coin is how you move it forward in the first place. And one of the things that I've been thinking a ton about lately is how we approach building products and just sort of, for lack of better terms, how bastardized that process in itself has become lately. You know, everybody has the lean startup mantra and lean startup methodology kind of beaten into them these days. But because it has become so much the Bible of how we build things, we've kind of lost sight of what it actually means to execute in that manner. And so I've been digging much more into, you know, things like customer development and the idea of almost slowing down a little bit. And it's interesting, there's another phrase from my past. I also used to spend a lot of time in the mountains. There's a mountaineering phrase that is, go slow to move fast. And basically what it means is, be deliberate in the choices that you're making so that you don't have a major accident. And of course, you know, if you're in the mountains, then accidents are potentially fatal. And so the stakes are higher. But, you know, when we're talking livelihoods on the line in terms of building companies and things, there is still a lot on the line there. And so the idea of go slow to move fast, the idea of spend more time on customer development, understanding the pain points, understanding the problem that you're building around and solving for, and giving yourself the permission to test in smaller increments, to build in smaller increments, and to fail, to bring it back, to fail faster, but to fail faster in smaller increments means that you don't have to walk things back so far. You know, you can, there's a way to go about it where, to your point, you're not building the car, you know, you're building, I don't know, the hubcap. And right. You go, hey, how do you like our hubcap? Yeah. Well, what do I do with a hubcap? Oh, we're going to build this thing called a car. But right. For now, you can use the hubcap, you know, for this. And this is a terrible analogy because a hubcap doesn't have a whole lot of uses, or, you know, the MVP of a hubcap is still a hubcap, but you get my point.
Like in Brooklyn, they probably will put Eggs Benedict on a hubcap. I'm just throwing that out there.
They probably would. And as soon as I find that, I'm going to snap a bunch of photos and send it to you. But yes, that's, you know, that's kind of where my head was going too. Like, well, it's going to be a hubcap. It's going to go in a car, but today it's a plate and tomorrow it's a Frisbee.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. Well, I think that actually gets into what I want to talk about next. Right. So like, fail beautifully, I think, is beautiful, no pun intended. And the idea of approaching things with a willingness and openness to failure, I think is like a thing that I'm hearing from you and a thing that I definitely believe is like really healthy. However, the goal is still to not fail.
Yes. Right?
Like the goal is still to be successful. So you just brought one thing up, right? Which is like slow down to move fast, which is, you know, anybody who's ever been rock crawling in a Jeep knows like, sometimes just putting your pedal down is not going to work for you. Like you kind of need to be really thoughtful about where your wheel is going every moment.
Yes.
So what are some of the other things that you've picked up, or the other, like, I guess, practices that you've employed to get yourself sort of thinking about like, okay, if we fail here, it's fine. But I know if we do X, Y, or Z, we're less likely to fail because of what I've already experienced.
Again, what I'm constantly reminding myself of lately is spending more time understanding the problem so that when you get to the point of failure, it's incremental failure. It's small, it's tiny. It's a thing that you can move past. And then beyond that, a lot of this comes down to company culture. You know, you and I are talking about failure, and it's very easy as people who are running companies to think about failure and making it okay. But if you don't allow that mentality to trickle down to other people on your team and make them comfortable with the same notion of failure, then you can tell the world to fail as often as you want. But if you don't live and breathe that, and if you don't make it okay for the people that are around you to also fail, then you're doing them and yourself a disservice, and you're really not living up to the idea of failure. It can't only apply to you. It's got to apply to everybody. And whether that is failure or whether we're talking innovation and whether we're talking small teams or large teams, it really comes down to imbuing your team with this culture of it's okay to fail. Our goal here is to learn. Our goal here is to figure out what works and what doesn't as quickly as possible with as little expenditure as possible. But that doesn't mean that you can't try. And again, that's sort of that dichotomy of, well, you have to try in order to fail. So you're going to fail. But it's okay if you fail as long as you approach it as an opportunity to learn and figure out how not to fail in the same way the next time. I don't care if you fail again. Right. You know, but it's different if you're just going to keep making the same mistake over and over again. I mean, you move from failure to ignorance at some point in that process.
Yeah. It's funny. All I can keep thinking is that the mind shift also then, specifically about when you're modeling the behavior, mm-hmm. is that it's also really, really being clear about what success looks like, right?
Yes.
Because by widening the view of success to include find out things not to do, ways that we didn't like that this worked. Oh my God, this was really cool. Like if you broaden that spectrum, then the likelihood of failure gets a lot smaller because you sort of are making failing really specific to we did something that we knew we shouldn't have done.
Yeah.
Or that we could have done, like, I don't know, differently maybe.
Yeah, no, it's really interesting. So a lot of my thoughts on failure come from personal experience and things like that. But believe it or not, I've actually done a little bit of research into it as well. There's a Harvard professor by the name of Amy Edmondson who has studied failure, and she talks about it a lot. And she has created what she calls the spectrum of failure. And so it is this idea that on one end of the spectrum, you're kind of living and breathing what we're talking about. So failure is an opportunity to learn, failure in pursuit of something new. And that arguably is quote unquote good failure. Whereas if you're failing because you as an individual are ignoring the processes or norms, for example, that are set up to help you accomplish something, then it's a failure of ignorance, basically. It's a failure of ignorance if you don't know that those processes are in place. If you continue to ignore it, then it's a purposeful failure. And at some point, you know, speaking hypothetically, if there's a person on your team who is just bucking process, for example, and refuses to do things in the way that work best for your team because you've tried it and established it and know that, then, you know, at some point you start looking at whether or not they're the right fit. And there's still a failure there, but then in my mind, I start questioning whether that failure falls more to me as a leader. Did I hire the wrong person? Was I not clear enough in explaining how we try to accomplish things? Did I not help them learn in a manner that might have prevented this situation? And it's really tough because, you know, I've certainly found myself in the occasional position where somebody had to go and I look back on it going, man, I really wish I had done X, Y, and Z differently because, you know, firing somebody is never fun. It's not the ultimate goal, obviously. And so you start looking at where those failures fall. And so, yes, maybe that person failed and that failure of theirs prompted reaction from you. But then you also have to look inwardly and figure out where you failed them in that regard. And so to bring it back to the point here, Edmondson has this whole spectrum of where along the line of things did you fail and how can you prevent those types of failures in the future? So, you know, if you have a process that's failing, well, fix the process and then that failure won't happen. But if you fail to fix the process because you've ignored it, for example, then that failure is no longer a failure of process. It's a failure of you as a person or you as a leader.
Yeah. And my favorite thing about that spectrum she has is that she differentiates between its inadequacy, like process inadequacy and process, I forget what it's complexity.
Yes. Right?
So I have a process that does not work. I have a process that might work, but it's too much. And the fact that those are different places in the spectrum, one, complexity is better because complexity is easier to fix than bad process. But yes, identifying the complexity is a problem.
Yes.
Like one of the big takeaways that I had from that was like, because I, you know, like every good long-term product manager, I have grown to hate process and love it. Like I know exactly how much I want and I know exactly how much I don't want. And it is a razor thin line.
Yes.
In my career.
Yes. Yeah. It's one of those lines that you can trip over in a heartbeat and kind of go, ah, crap.
Oh, it's appear. So thin. It's so thin. Yeah. But I like this idea. Just the idea of failure on a spectrum too, I think is a really important takeaway because you're right. Like every failure is either good or bad. In the sense that it was, well, there's no bad failure if you learn from it. But the idea that you walk away from failing and can look internally at why you failed and either figure out that you did something wrong, someone else had intentions that were wrong, or it failed beautifully, right? Yes. Which is like, oh, everyone did exactly what we thought they were going to do. We all paid attention. Communication was great. And the thing that we thought was wrong, awesome. Like, cool.
At which point you've just proven a hypothesis wrong and you learn from it, which is great.
Yeah. Which is again, and that's success. Like
successfully learned something by failing.
Yeah. And it's in science, a failed hypothesis is a successful hypothesis.
Exactly.
It moves you closer to the right, like to the right one. So yeah, I think it's so funny. The relationship between success and failure is so inherently like I've never thought of any of this before. Like I think about failure all the time. Because it's where I live, right? I mean, it's
don't we all, man?
Well, I do think it's fun though, right? Because product people, of which you and I are, right? Like we are constantly thinking about what will work in the lens of what wouldn't. Yes. Like most of my time when I'm actually diagnosing problems and products for myself or for my company or just in general, I'm looking at a thing and going, that's not going to work because. ..."
Yep.
And it's because in the absence of, like, you don't know exactly what is going to work, but you, especially if you do this for a long time, man, like, you and I both have that sense. You see a thing and you're like, nope,
not good. Yeah. No. And I was, yeah, I was, it's funny. I was just about to say, like, that's the benefit of experience is, you know, failure over a long period of time, we call experience, and it's cultivating that ability to look at something and go, I don't need to fail trying that. I can already tell you it's not going to work.
Yeah, that 100% is not going to work. But then I think to your point earlier, like the idea of opening up the boundaries of where and what is a good thing and what everybody's happy with, I think is really important. I think especially as a leader, that's a really good takeaway. Just this idea of setting the expectation clearly in the beginning that on the other side of this, it gets better.
Yes.
And as long as that's the case, win, then good for us, right? And, and like having a tolerance for only, I mean, you know, there has to be a tolerance for how long you can do that without actually hitting the nail. Like eventually you do have to hit the nail. But
that's where that thick skin comes back. Or there's a really great like video or quote from Sam Altman about determination and the importance of determination and entrepreneurship. And the moment that you've just described is the moment where I sort of feel like that comes into play. It's how many times can you get knocked on your butt and stand up again and go, all right, that didn't work.
Right. Well, it's one of the only quotes I've ever had that I actually really liked was, you know, like it was a long time ago. You actually might've even been there. It was in New York. It was on stage forever ago. And somebody was on stage talking about like hustle culture and all that stuff. And I was like, look, I was like, some of you guys just have bad ideas. Like it's just not going to work. Like some of your business models suck, right? 100% of entrepreneurs are great. 95% of business models are terrible. So like there is a maturity that comes with embracing failure, because you also have to get to a point where you get to the point and you get like, and you get there and you go, all right, this is straight up not working. Right. Like, we got to rethink. Like now it's time to really, really step back and rethink. Yes. Because unfortunately, like we are for-profit enterprises, right? So like there has to be an end game somewhere. I wish that wasn't the case, but you know, until somebody figures that out, that's the case.
Yeah. Yeah. No question.
So when you think about, so this is kind of my, like, we'll start to wrap up and I have to get to my questionnaire, but is there any examples of a company or, and I also want to extend this to art, because I know that you're really into art and you talked about your theater experience before. Mm-hmm. Like, is there any example of a company or someone or something failing beautifully publicly that you thought went amazingly, where you were like, see, that's the example of how you should do that?
Oh, I should totally have a back pocket answer for that. The thing that pops into my head immediately right now, I spent a lot of time when I was focused on theater doing improv. And improv is one of those things where it either goes beautifully well and everybody's laughing and so on and so forth, or it falls dead flat and you're standing on stage going, wait for it. Somebody's going to laugh, and they don't. And it's just utterly painful. And to me, that is the epitome of it, because this is sort of off the cuff, but when you stand up in front of a group of people and you don't know what's coming next, that is just the full embodiment of fail beautifully. And I guess it is also the example of how all of this kind of circles back to my starting in theater. It's that moment of, I'm going to put myself out here. I have no idea what's going to happen. It might be an utter mess that makes me uncomfortable, which might make you uncomfortable, whatever, but we're all going to get through it together. And when it hits, then, you know, there's no question. Everybody knows it when you sit through a great improv show and everybody's cracking up and the whole thing. But when it doesn't, there's also that pained silence of, oh, wait, no, that one didn't hit.
Yeah, it's funny. I just had Barry Wright on, who we did a whole thing on improvising because he started an improv group. And it's funny. Like, it's about how he leverages that for work. And it was crazy. It was so fascinating because it's true, right? Like, it really is about like communication and being able to dive in, which is like such a cool skill.
So massively important. Like it's funny. I mean, I was a theater kid up through the end of high school. And of course I had declared to my parents that when I went to college, I was going to stop, because obviously it wasn't going to become a lucrative career path and so on and so forth. And clearly, as our conversation has indicated, I did not stop. And for years, you know, my parents looked at me and went, really? I mean, really, a theater degree? You have a degree in acting? Like, come on. That's what you went to college for? And about, might have been about 10 years ago now, my mom, of all people, has finally sort of like turned the corner on it, and she's admitted it. So there's value in it, but she has even said to me, like, wow, the impact that your theater training has had on your career, on your ability and comfort level with speaking to people. And it doesn't even have to be, you know, on a stage or in front of people, just even one-on-one, the ability to sit down and kind of align your thoughts and say what's on your mind has a massive impact. And to appease my parents at the time, I also got a second degree in marketing, which eventually led me to the advertising path and has nothing to do with whatsoever with what I do today. But that was my, like, okay, I'm going to appease my parents kind of compromise. And I got to tell you, I rely on my acting degree every single day. And yeah. I cannot tell you the last time that I rattled off the four P's of marketing.
It's so funny. I tell people a lot, especially when I do, like, you know, like talk to college kids or whatever, like mm-hmm. that sort of stuff. Like, so I went to school for evolutionary psychology, and I had a minor in business, like business administration. So double major towards the end. And yeah, I mean, look, I don't know. Like, did I learn anything from environments of law? I don't know. Like, I have no idea if any of that stayed with me. But what I learned about why people do the things they do and the psychology of behavior of people has impacted my life so dramatically.
Exactly.
Because it makes me curious and it makes me ask questions and it makes me understand why people do. Like, it has helped me. The fact that, like, they don't do more, like, actual brain chemistry studies for kids in design, specifically when it comes to, like, UX, like, there's a cortisol hit, man. Like, this is your body reacts to this stuff. Like, it's
real. Oh, yeah. I got into a whole conversation with somebody recently about dopamine loops and, like, how do we build dopamine loops into application experiences and things like that. And, like, your point's well taken. I mean, I think that I can only assume that they're starting to based on, I don't know, that one conversation, which clearly makes me an expert. You know, like, yes, there is thought to be had there. And, you know, we're looking back on, you know, decades of social media, or a decade plus of social media now, for example, and looking at the impact that that's had on people and, you know, brain development and all of that stuff. And I think, I don't know, I wouldn't be surprised if we start seeing more and more of that and learning just how much we've ruined ourselves in the process.
Yeah. The one thing I have to say, this is so self-indulgent, but I have to, is this whole conversation, I've been thinking about jazz. Like, when you watch really, really masterful jazz musicians play together, it's a cacophony of failure. It's just one after the other of, like, not quite the right note, not quite the right time, not necessarily in sync. Like, there's all these little nuancy things that they have to recover from immediately or that changes a song. And it's just, it's like, it's that to me is, like, one of my favorite examples of failing publicly is, like, when you watch really good musicians have to make it work together at the same time. It's so, like, that to me, it's very similar to improv, right? It's that.
I was just about to say that. Like, what you're describing is musical improv.
Yeah, which in my head, that's it. Like, it's so cool, and that to me is, like, really, really, really good teams. You can see that happen. Like, I've been around. I love when engineering teams kind of have that spark. Yes. I have a guy I work with right now who's one of those kind of brains that, like, can turn a thing that was wrong into a right thing. Very quickly. And it's so cool when you watch somebody kind of, like, navigate that path in real time. Like, it's one of the great joys of product management is having cool engineers.
Yeah, no, I agree. We've been lucky in that we have a couple of kind of pair teams of engineers that are absolutely jazz musicians in their own right, kind of to take your analogy. And it's so incredible to watch them. We have one pair that we literally call the Wonder Twins because they do, like, we have stopped assigning tasks separately, and someone, like, we assign them as though they're a single engineer, and the work that they get done between the two of them is just, it's beautiful to behold. It's impressive how much they get done, how quickly, and, like, they're a joy to work with.
That's so fun. Yeah. All right. We're hitting time. We got to get to my final question. So, originally written by Bernard Pivot, made famous by James Lipton, amended by me for no reason. What is a quote or a concept that you love?
Fail beautifully.
I mean, that feels on the nose and perfect. Thanks. What's a quote or a concept that you dislike or have strong feelings against?
You should ... Every time I see, like, I don't know, scrolling through LinkedIn these days is kind of cringeworthy because it's just post after post of, if you're a blank, you should blank. And it's so frustrating because it's so generic, and it's like, stop telling me what I should do. You're not sitting in my shoes. You don't know the situation that I'm in, and yet your "you should" is so universally delivered that I can't help but to hate, like, just kind of hate you for it.
That's hilarious, and I totally understand that feeling. What's a job other than your own you would love to have?
Architect. I'm by no means qualified for it, but I love the design of spaces, and there's an element of UX that comes into play in spaces. How do people interact with, navigate, move through, etc.? And if I were in some other life, I would love to be an architect.
So I have this like fun little theory very quickly. Product people want to be architects, and engineers want to build bridges. Because product people want you to walk through a space and feel incredible. Engineers want you to look at a bridge and go, how the fuck is that possible?
That's fair. But what if I want to build a house that makes you go, how the fuck did you think of that?
But see, that's feeling. Like there's a feeling to like I like the, because like, again, I think to your point, it's moving through a space where you go, oh my God, I never would have thought to do this.
Yeah.
Engineers, I like the joke. It's a joke. Not all engineers are like,
of course.
But the idea, the sweeping generalization of engineers is like, they don't want you to know how it works. They just want you to know.
They just want you to be impressed by it.
It's fucking magic, dog. Like,
yeah, that's fair. And that's a good point. That is a good nuance there.
What's a job other than your own that you would absolutely not want to have?
Anything that requires mass amounts of patience with other people. Customer service, being a teacher. What's that?
So living.
Yeah. No, maybe. Yeah, patience is not always my strong suit.
Yeah, I was going to say there's one of the things that I knew that, like, you know, therapy and meditating was working is how much nicer I am to call centers now, where I'm just like, oh my God, I'm so sorry you have to do this too, because you also don't want to be on this phone right now.
Well, yes. And that's exactly, yes. And putting yourself in that person's shoes is what makes me go, oh God, I could not. And like, I mean, let me be clear. I've done customer support for many product launches, things like that. It's just, it's one of those things where you just kind of slap that smile on and you go, okay.
Yeah.
I'm just going to grin and bear it.
Yeah. What turns you on spiritually, creatively, or emotionally?
Solving problems. Nothing gets me going like, how do I do blank?
Yeah. So good. What turns you off spiritually, creatively, or emotionally?
Working with folks who aren't able to engage constructively, like people who don't want to be a part of the process, or that moment where, you know, somebody does the least amount possible to claim that they completed the thing because they don't really want to be doing the thing. I just shut down in those moments. I'm just, oh God, really? Like, okay, I'm out. Yeah.
Fair. What is a product you absolutely love?
I have two for this, and they are attached in my mind. They're not necessarily attached. So one goes back to my days of like Legos and things. There's a product out called aluminum extrusion, and it sounds so dumb and industrial and whatever, but it's basically these like aluminum tubes, if you will, that have channels in the sides that you can like bolt things onto, or think of them as an erector set for adults. It's like it's a life-size erector set.
Sick.
And so I started working with that stuff when I was working on a side gig a while ago, and that led me to a company that is one of my absolute favorite things in the world called Send Cut Send, which is a laser cutting bending manufacturing company. And what I absolutely adore about them is that I, who would love to fancy myself as a designer of like things, tangible things that you could touch, an industrial designer, but I'm not at all. I can draw a 2D picture in Illustrator, for example, and send it in, and they will turn it into a real life 3D thing that I can like touch and do stuff with. And so I am infinitely obsessed with just like making things and having them show up on my doorstep going, I made that thing. It's great.
First of all, what a beautiful name. That's one of the best names I've ever heard in my whole
life. Yes. Yes. It's phenomenal.
Oh my God, that's so good. Also, I was unfamiliar with them, and my wife's going to hate you because I'm going to have a bunch of shit sent to my house now that I know I can do that. Because
so
many of those little things I like write down. I'm like, wouldn't it be cool if I had this thing that did this thing? But I'm not a machinist, so it's not an option.
Oh, everything. I mean, I got like a sign for our new apartment that says like apartment one this way that I made, and like I'm literally you can't. I'm literally just like, I have stuff sitting all over my apartment that came from them. That's just like, yes, I love that. Like, this is here.
Yeah, things. I like things. What's a product that you wish was better or have very strong feelings about?
Everything.
Yep, that's right. Spoken like a true product person.
Yeah, everything. I want everything to be better.
Yeah, yeah. All right, final question. If you could solve any one problem through technology, what would it be?
I thought long and hard about this one. And what I really kind of came down to is, not to sound like a complete like technology fanboy, and I am hyperbolizing on purpose here, but what can't be solved by technology? Or another way to look at that is, I firmly believe that many of the world's largest problems can and eventually will be solved by technology. The barrier to the solution is not the technology itself, but is the willingness of people to accept it. So if you're looking at anything from global warming to wealth inequality to, I don't know, healthcare, like whatever it is, the problem, obviously some of those problems we have yet to create the technology to solve, but what I worry about is the willingness of those who hold the keys to the kingdom in accepting the new technology and kind of enabling world impacting change to happen, because it might mean that they have to give up a couple of points on their bottom line.
Well said. Agreed. I adore you. Thank you so much for doing this. This is fun.
Thanks for having me. I always love chatting with you. You know that.
Yeah. We could do this for hours and hours, but
we could,
because of podcast rules, we got to keep it down. Thank you, man, for doing this. And I love watching what you're building, and I love that you're building in public, and appreciate you, man.
Thank you.